Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Well, we're back to the Royals again this week. We were going to take a break, but actually we had a very good opportunity to talk to Michael Cole, who I think will be very interesting. It returns us to the subject of Diana and Diana's death. And I think there'll be some fascinating new insights.
Yes, we were going to take a break from the Royals. Honestly, we were, because a few people actually have said, you're doing too much Royal stuff. On the other hand, a lot of people also enjoy it. Though we were planning to do a programme on Jimmy Savile, but that had to be delayed. And as Andrew says, we had the chance to speak to Michael Cole, who has a really, he's got a terrific insight into all this, because for 10 years he worked for the Fayyad family, the Al Fayyad family.
Yeah, and before that, as the BBC Royal Correspondent, I've been talking to him from my Andrew book, and he's full of fascinating information of that period. And he's quite forthright. You know, I think a lot of royal correspondents can be quite careful, but he's always very articulate and always has something interesting to say.
I remember him from the Brighton bombing. I mean, he was one of the BBC's top reporters when they tried to assassinate the cabinet. Do you remember? And he was part of that coverage.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we forget all these royal reporters often had other careers doing very, very different sorts of subjects. And I think that's what makes them such good journalists. But it'll be interesting to see, because he's very much gone on the record as saying that there are unanswered questions about Diana's death, and one of the few journalists to do that.
So, well, also, he's one of the few people that knew personally Dodie and Diana and saw them through that relationship. And saw the role that Mohammed Al Fayyad played or didn't play in it. That'll be really, I want to ask him more about that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's often a certain narrative that's emerged, and it's not necessarily the true narrative. And someone like that may have some new insights into it. So I think it'll be a good royal episode. And even if we perhaps take a break from the next couple of weeks and go on to other subjects, but it all depends on the listeners, what they want to.
Well, it does. And if you have that, there was a couple of reviews on Apple said I'm getting tired of data. So you can just flip to the next one if you like, but all stay and listen, because I think you'll find Michael has a very different voice and he's not spoken much. In fact, he told us we had a funny exchange with him. He doesn't really know what a podcast is.
Yeah, no, exactly. No. I mean, I think he's quite a coup to get.
So he's not done much of this. And he actually was teasing me because I'm just back from Madeira, where I was in the last episode, showing off from my balcony. And he's been there a lot too, but in a rather posher hotel called Reed's. So he's been teasing me about that. So I expect that'll come up in the interview as well.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it will. And what are the comments coming in? And how are the viewing figures? Because I think it's clear the Royals are the things that people seem to be listening to.
People do love the Royal stuff. I mean, you know, what's interesting to me, though, is that some of our older shows still get a lot of attention and are growing. I think we're approaching 200,000 downloads now across YouTube, Apple, Spotify, which is, I think somebody once said to us, if you do 100,000 in a year, you'll have done well. So we've doubled that.
Gosh.
Yeah, a lot of new people finding us. The conversation with Richard Kay, I think it's our seventh most popular ever, and it's only been up 4 days. Quiet Australian 2284, Rev D. Wendy, Kaza Swan, oh, excuse me, I'm going to have to not take that. Kaza Swan, Donald Black, 5530, consistently great series, thank you both. Looking at all your other shows, absolutely brilliant podcast, says Carol Roy. I'm going back looking at all the old shows. So that's the model, I think. People find us through a royal story, and then suddenly they find themselves interested in what we said about COVID or the post office crisis or any of the other things we've done.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, I mean, someone suggested we do something on the Oakes murder in the Bahamas in 1943, and I would certainly be happy to speak to that or to find someone who could talk to that.
And we're looking at more miscarriages of justice stories coming up. Like I say, Jimmy Savile, which is an amazing story. So lots to enjoy. But I think Michael might surprise people. I think he's probably going to be a bit different to the average royal pundit.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. And no doubt we'll have lots of reactions to report on next week.
Yes. Please tell us what you think. See you soon.
Bye.
Well, I was going to start actually by asking you to talk a little bit about your experience. It must have been an extraordinary experience over many years working for the Fyad family, who don't always get a very positive account of, you know, in the media, but you were so close to them for so long. I'd love to know what your, you know, what you took away from that.
I knew Mohammed before I worked for him. I knew him for 18 months, 2 years before I worked for him. I went and made a film called The Uncrowned Jewels, which was about the jewelry that the Duke of Windsor lavished upon Mrs. Simpson, who became the Duchess of Windsor. And that was my title for it. Somebody said, well, they call it the Wallace Collection. I said, well, people won't understand the Wallace Collection unless they're devotees of fine arts. But The Uncrowned Jewels was accurate because, of course, he was never crowned. And that film, which was broadcast at around Easter time, 1987, to coincide with the record-breaking auction of the Duchess of Windsor's jewels in Geneva. That program was seen by 14 million eyeballs. It was the most popular documentary that was ever on the BBC, apart from The Royal Family. And that film, although made by the BBC, was the Queen's property. She retained the copyright, as she does to this day. So making that film, I actually needed to get to film inside the Windsor Villa in the Bois de Boulogne, just outside the centre of Paris, where they lived and indeed where both of them died, the Duke of Windsor in 1972 and the Duchess in May 86. And after she died, Mohammed was offered the house by the mayor of Paris, Jacques Chirac, who later became the president of France. And he was he took it over, and Chirac said to him, look, you know, you've made such a wonderful job of the Ritz Hotel and you have connections in Britain. Would you like to take over this house? So Mohammed said he would take it over. It was quite an interesting little house, a bijou house, if you will, as a stately home. It had originally been built by Monsieur Renault. But Monsieur Renault had collaborated rather enthusiastically with the Nazis during the occupation of France, and he was forfeited his house. And after the war, it was owned by the French state, owned, I think, an ex-king of Morocco and lived there for a bit. Anyway, the Windsors, who were at a loose end, they'd had apartments in Paris before the war, they took it over, and he died there and she died there. So Mohammed took it over. And as a result of that, I met Mohammed. I made the film. It went out. It was successful. And then about 18 months later, he invited me to join his company. Well, of course, I thought I was going to be at the BBC forever. I was that sort of loyal lifer person. I was only one of the foot soldiers, but I actually thought that public service broadcasting meant something and was important. And I was loyal to it. The BBC is never loyal to you, though, unfortunately. I risked my life on many occasions, put myself and my crew in dangerous positions, But the BBC takes no account of that. So I thought at the age of 45, which I then was, I thought, well, if I stay here another 6 years or 7 years, they'll get rid of me, as they got rid of much better correspondents than myself when they reached that age, not realizing that experience has value. So I thought, well, okay, I'm going to swap the BBC for Harrods, both names which are known around the world. And after some hesitation, I did so. And I didn't do so for the money, because I was paid not much more than I was getting at the BBC. And I stayed there for 10 years. And I wouldn't have worked for Mohammed if I didn't like him. And I did like him. I've always liked him. And I liked him after I worked for him.
What were the qualities about him that you liked?
He's very generous and very kind and very thoughtful person. Anybody who was in trouble, particularly if they had a health problem, he would immediately intervene and help them. I mean, he would, he'd see somebody in the shop having trouble with their back or something. He'd send them straight off to Harley Street to have some attention. We had a managing director who had a prostate gland cancer problem. I mean, he put him straight on his airplane to America. Of course, they do the operation in this country equally as well, but Mohammed thought this surgeon in America was a specialist. He did that. I mean, he was like a walking pharmacy. He had pills and so on. I mean, walk around the place, say if you've got a cold or you've got something. He always had something. He was extremely kind, and particularly to families he didn't even know who were in trouble. And I would be the abominable no man. I'd say, we don't need to do all this stuff. We don't need to help these families, children who were in trouble. And he'd say, no. We do something good, you come back as something wonderful. You do something bad, you come back as a snake or an ant or a rat. So I said, Mohammed, this is not Islam. This is not Christianity. This is Buddhism, you know, reincarnation. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We do something good, it will be good for us. And he had that approach to life. If I told you that every month, every single month, he gave to four different children's hospices around this country £40,000 each in Liverpool, in Manchester, in Surrey, and there was one in Kent. And those people relied upon that. So taxed money that he paid tax on, he gave them each. You added up 40 grand each every month, because that was children's hospices, and he felt that that was important.
It's funny, because his reputation is nothing like what you're describing. Most people, and I remember the spitting image at the time, led the way. He was a bad-tempered, foul-mouthed, aggressive caricature. It just doesn't sound anything like what you're saying.
Well, believe you me, Mohammed never, ever raised his voice to me, and he never used profane language of any kind, any time. I mean, I swore at him. I've heard far much worse in BBC newsrooms and other newsrooms I've lived in throughout my career, what passes for my career. Dreadful stuff. And I occasionally lost my temper with him, usually twice a year. I resigned on a couple of occasions and then came back. But he was always even-tempered, and when I'd had an outburst, he would send a glass of rich champagne up the corridor to my office, and he'd say to my PA, "Tell Michael to calm down. Just tell him to calm down, silly boy. Be quiet." You see, but my job was to be the abominable no man. He didn't need a yes man. He had plenty of people saying yes to him. My job was to say no. And there are in this life. For every 10 ideas, there's one good one. The 9 bad ones have to be strangled quietly without putting too many people's noses out of joint. And when you get a good idea, you get behind that. So my purpose there was to say no about things. But listen, I didn't have any illusions about it. I was working for him. He accomplished a great deal in his life, most of it before he ever met me. All I was there was to advise and to do my best. Fortunately, I'd worked extensively in the Middle East. I'd worked in about 16 out of the 22 Arab countries, and in Israel, Lebanon, all of these places. 10 years of civil war in in Beirut and so on. So I understood a little bit about the Arab mindset, but he would say, no, 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 I'm Egyptian, Michael. I'm not an Arab, you know, because Alexandria was the epitome. It was the essence of cosmopolitanism. Before 1948, when the State of Israel was established, there were about 250,000 Jews lived in Alexandria, the second biggest city in the world of Jews. New York was number one. Second was Alexandria. At the time, Tel Aviv was just a sand dune, a little bit up the coast. And Muhammad would say, you know, there was everybody there, Turks, Greeks, Copts, Maronite Christians. Everybody was mixed together. And he said it was a fantastic place to grow up. And he said to me, his father was, he would say, a professor of Arabic. He was an Arabic teacher, very learned. And when I ever see pictures of his father, I see also his brother. Ali looked extremely like his father. Muhammad didn't. And Muhammad said, I learned everything I learned from my grandfather. He was a merchant. He had a warehouse and next to an old Jewish merchant. And those two men, they taught me everything I knew about business. And I like Muhammad because he was go ahead. He had vision. And he single-handedly rescued the department store. Before Muhammad came along, department stores were regarded as dusty dowager duchesses with little prospect of a future. And they were all closing down. If I mention Bourne and Hollingsworth to you, Marshall and Snellgrove, Woolens, all of these shops don't exist any longer. And it was all boutiques and people were going away from department stores. Well, Muhammad didn't have that. He wouldn't have it. And he invested of his own money about £600 million over 25 years, a quarter of a century. And because he invested in the department store and the idea of the department store and upgraded it, the others, Harvey Nichols and Selfridges, had to raise their act, which they did very successfully. It's an absolutely wonderful example of competition working.
So it's so nice and refreshing to hear this take on him. I mean, I have to ask, did you get to know his son Dodi at this time as well?
Of course.
We want to come to that relationship with Dodi and Diana.
Of course, of course. But I wrote an article which was published at the time of his death, which I gladly emailed to you. It was published in more than one publication. And if your podcast customers want a copy of it, it actually tells you far more than I can tell you in this brief conversation. But I liked him, and he was a family man. He was not the slightest bit interested in society, going to nightclubs, going to the right restaurants. He was interested in his family. He was interested in his customers. He was interested in his staff, and he was interested in his businesses. And I mean, he so loved Harrods that if he went on holiday, he couldn't stay away more than 4 days wherever he was in the world. He would fly back just to make sure his mistress, if you like, the store was ticking over. Of course, it was ticking over all right without him, but he just missed it. And he came. In fact, the only time I remember him being away from the store for more than 4 days was the terrible week when his eldest son and the family's dear friend Diana were killed.
Well, can we talk more about that? Because I'd love to know. You paint a very surprising and refreshing picture of Muhammad. Well, what Dodi was like.
You've been influenced by a scruffy little magazines written by schoolboys that characterize him. I mean, I with my hand on my heart, I swear that I never heard Muhammad swear ever.
Fantastic. Oh, look. That's so interesting. But can we move on to Dodi and Diana? Because Andrew maybe would like to ask a question to you. It's just me at the moment, sorry. But I'm very keen to know what you made of Dodi and that romance and where it was going.
Well, it's a huge question. I'm the only person in the world who knew all three people who were killed that night. I knew Henri Paul. He used to drive me around in Paris. We got on quite well. And I'll tell you how much I had in him. My wife was never a BBC wife. She was never wanting to associate herself with her husband, what he was doing. She wasn't that sort of person. So she very rarely came with me on holiday or on business. But my wife and daughter did come with me on one occasion to Paris because the cards fell right. And Henri Paul drove them around during that day to museums and wherever they wanted to go. Do you think I would have allowed a man of terrible character who would be a drunken driver to drive them around, my wife and daughter? Of course not. I knew him. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner, John Stevens, Lord Stevens, when he went to the British Embassy during his inquiries, the Paget inquiry, he said to Henri Paul's parents, who were just very ordinary people from Brittany who'd come up on the train, I think probably it was the only time they'd ever been to Paris. They were ordinary, nice people. And he said, putting out his arms, "Your son will not be blamed. He will not be blamed for this terrible tragedy." That was witnessed by the detective inspector, Jane Scotchbrook, who was with him, and she gave evidence to it. And, of course, when the Paget report was published on the 17th of December 2007, he was blamed. And that report itself, of course, was prejudicial. Everybody knew that there was an inquest pending, the two inquests, the dual inquest of Dodie and Diana. And yet the police brought out this this report, which sought to be judge and jury before a jury had even been empaneled. So make of you what of that what you wish. But I thought it was disgraceful. I thought it was prejudicial. It should never have been done, and particularly in that way. But to answer your question, of course, I knew Dodie for 12 years. I knew Diana for 12 years. As the BBC court correspondent, I went round the world with Diana when she was Princess of Wales and when she was Diana, Princess of Wales, after her divorce. And, of course, I knew them both. I wasn't a buddy of theirs. I didn't go out to dinner. They didn't ask me round for afternoon tea. It wasn't that sort of relationship. But I got on with them both very well. I liked Dodie. I liked him. He was a gentle and kind and very generous and nice person. And it actually is very hurtful to see dreadful things said about him, which I know personally to be untrue. But what can you do? With regard to Diana, I was a reporter. She was being reported upon. She was very street smart. You know, when she said, "I'm as thick as two short planks," absolutely wrong. She read the room all the time. She was very astute. She knew what we were doing. She knew how to give a pose that would make her look good. And of course, she never, rather like Marilyn Monroe, she never took a bad photograph. She always looked great whenever you saw her. And I liked her. I really liked her. And you know what? The real secret of the world's fascination with Diana Spencer, Lady Diana Spencer, Diana, Princess of Wales, as she was when she died, the real fascination is this, that Diana put people in touch with the better side of themselves. We all have faults. She had faults. She didn't think she was an angel. She didn't think she was perfect. She didn't think she was wonderful. But she did good things, and she made a difference, and she was kind, and she was loving, and she was a perfect person. And she did a tremendous amount for the royal family. There she was, their star, and they could do nothing but criticize her and try to bring her down. It was quite terrible. But she had humor, too, and she saw the funny side of it. You have to remember, you know, the key to this is quite simple. Diana was a six-year-old child. She stood by the gate. Her mother, Frances, walked out on her beloved father, Johnny, walked out, left the children alone. She and Charles, her brother, who was younger than her, were young, very young at that stage. The two older sisters were a little bit more capable of coping with a situation like that. And I believe that Diana, throughout her life, what she wanted was to regain what she lost. And what she lost was a happy family life. And when she saw the Fayeds, she was in a happy family. And I think that's what attracted her to Dodie more than anything initially. was how wonderful he was with his own four siblings, his half-brothers and sisters, although Mohammed would say, not half-brothers, they are brothers, they are sisters, you know, not half-brothers. But he was terrific. They regarded him as an older brother, Dodi, with Mohammed's four children, with his wife, Haini. And I think that would have rung a bell with her. And Diana loved being with the Fayed family because they were relaxed. They were not on formal terms. They didn't, you know, her royal status and her son's royal status didn't matter. I mean, of course, they respected a bit and they knew about it, but it wasn't a factor in the friendship that was there. And I think when she saw Dodi, who was tremendously kind, with his own siblings, she could see. And of course, the Fayed children were around the same ages as William and Harry were at that time. I mean, when they were in Saint-Tropez, because there was press interest after it became known that she was there, of course, on the Saturday morning, which I remember quite clearly, they couldn't really go anywhere except on their boats to get away from people. So Dodi hired the leading discotheque in Saint-Tropez for the evening. And of course, they all went there and they asked their friends, they asked their trusted friends, so they could have an evening out. They didn't want to be completely just kept in this hermetically sealed bubble of the Mohammed's estate there. He would do things like that, and he was very thoughtful. As a man, I can never really understand what women see in a man. Therefore, you know, women have never been a great fan of mine. But my wife, who's very shrewd, she said, Dodi is so just lovely to talk to. And he had, Diana loved his sort of mid-Atlantic voice, halfway between the Middle East and Los Angeles somewhere. And she recorded messages he left on her phone and played them to her friends and said, listen to his voice. Well, I think men fall in love through their eyes, women through their ears. It's what they hear. That makes the most. I mean, I've known women who've said, I couldn't marry any man with a horrible voice. You know,
that's so interesting.
A voice matters. Yeah, men are stupid. They just look at the woman, the figure, you know, the hair. Women not. They listen.
So this love that they had, you know, do you think they were destined to marry? Were they in fact engaged at the end?
Well, of course they were. Dodi was told me on more than one occasion how deeply he was in love with Diana. I would not have presumed to have asked Diana, Princess of Wales, about her personal life. I just wouldn't have done it. But the last time I saw her, and that was before the third holiday that fateful summer, and she was going away and she was going to meet Dodi, and we had a chat, and she was more full of joy and happiness than I've ever seen her. She was really on form. She was relaxed. She was looking forward to the future. And of course, there are plenty of people out there, the naysayers, the people who have their own little agendas. And they will say, well, of course, it was a holiday romance. It was just a fling. Well, first of all, I think that is total nonsense, because I have more respect for Diana, Princess of Wales, than that. Diana would not have done anything that would have embarrassed her sons, knowing they were going to go back to school and they would be teased. So if she was involved with any man, it had to be serious. This is in my mind. It had to be serious. And bear this in mind, this was her first affair since she was divorced. The other affairs she'd had were when she was separated from her husband, and they were covert, they were hidden, and they were carried out in some difficulty. And nobody knew about them. But on the boat and elsewhere, there were, besides the crew and besides the valet and her lady's maid, It was only them there. It was quite clear what the nature of the relationship was. And Diana, you know, believed that the Americans would give her a break. She'd been to America several times. I accompanied her on her first trip to America as a reporter. And she believed that the American media would give her the break that she would not get in this country or would never get in this country. And Dodie had bought a house on the beach at Malibu, which had been owned by Julie Andrews and her film producer husband, Blake Edwards. And I'd seen all the documents. I think it was Savills International, a big brochure and a floor plan. And Dodie had said to Diana, we'll go and live in Malibu. And the people who say, well, of course, it was just a fling, they can't, including her butler, Paul Burrell. But Burrell, in one or two of his books, recounts how the boss, which is how he called the princess, came home very excited to Kensington Palace and laid out on the rug in the drawing room the plans of this house and said, look, we're going to live in Malibu. This is where you're going to be with Maria, that's Burrell's wife. This is where your two boys will be, their bedrooms. This is the dance floor. This is the dance studio. This is the gym. This is the master bedroom. And she was excited about it. And so Burrell, who says, of course, it was just a fling, it wasn't serious, he was getting ready to go to Malibu. So what was all that about? Because I tell you what it was about. Diana believed, and Hollywood, the currency is celebrity. There is nothing else. And also, the Americans, unlike Britain is the home of nostalgia. The broken down actors who can't get any work in Hollywood, they all come here and they appear in pantomime and whatever else they do. This goes way back to Ben Lyon and B.B. Daniels, before your time, of course, either of you. But Hollywood stars who come here and find a new career. America wants the next thing. What's new? What's next? Novelty is everything there. And Diana believed that after a while, they'd get used to her and Dodie. And, you know, if you are in Hollywood and you go to Safeway and you're checking out your groceries and Kevin Costner's at the next checkout and, you know, Kirk Douglas's.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
fun is at the other one. Who cares? After a while, celebrity becomes commonplace. And I believe, I mean, Prince Harry, her son, has said in terms that he's living out his mother's destiny by going to California. Well, you know, maybe he knows more than I do. But your question was, were they engaged? I think that was what the question was. Well, René Delorme, who for a long time had been valet to Dodie, said that at the apartment in the rue Anson-Russet, just down from the Arc de Triomphe, which I've stayed at on more than one occasion, he said that Dodie told him to put champagne on ice, and he had a ring which he'd bought, which the princess had seen. It had been sold by the Iranian French jeweler Repoussy. It had been sold in France as "Dis-moi oui," tell me yes. That was the advert, a display advert for this ring. Does that suggest to you, tell me yes, it might have been an engagement ring? Does it, gentlemen? I don't know. But
I think it probably does. And I'm conscious that Andrew hasn't asked a question and I'm doing all the talking. Sorry, Andrew.
Let me just tell you this, because I think the Crown has got it all wrong. I mean, what happened the afternoon before they were so terribly killed? What happened was that Dodie, they'd been ashore in Monte Carlo. They'd been to Repoussy. They'd seen a representation of the "Dis-moi oui" ring, but it wasn't there. So Repoussy, who is very businesslike, said, "It'll be in Paris when you get to Paris." And when they were in Paris, that's one of the reasons they went there. They dropped in there for a last romantic night before they went home at the end of their holiday, as many couples would have done in more modest circumstances, perhaps. But haven't we all done it? And Dodie went across with the deputy manager of the Ritz Hotel, and the ring was there, and he selected it and two other rings, and they went back to the Ritz, and while the manager paid the bill and arranged all the details, and she selected the ring "Dis-moi oui," and the other two rings were put in the safe to be returned because the shop had closed on Monday morning. That's what happened. But anybody else will tell you whatever they want to hear, because they want to make out that the princess was not going to be involved. Now, were they going to marry? I don't know. There's so much we don't know. But the champagne was on ice. The ring was on the bedside. Dodie told me on more than one occasion and emphatically how much in love they were. But, you know, let me just tell you this, because it's circumstantial, but it's extremely strong circumstantial evidence. Dodie and Diana flew in a helicopter to an obscure village in Derbyshire to consult a soothsayer. I don't know what the correct term for people who make predictions about your future is, but one of those people who casts the runes and tells you your future. And Diana had consulted this woman for many, many years, and apparently believed what she said. And the woman in question, who does feature, I think, in The Crown, has said, I mean, they consulted her. Now, why would two people fly in a helicopter on quite a misty morning and had difficulty finding the house, and the helicopter had to fly up and down the valley to find the house, go there privately together? Could it possibly be, gentlemen, that they were saying, do we have a future together? What is our future together? The fact of the matter is they stayed together afterwards. They went back to Mohammed's country estate. They stayed the night, and then they had another holiday together, and that was the last one. We shall never know.
No, we obviously won't. I'm just conscious of the time and not to take too much of your time because you're...
No, it's fascinating. I mean, why do you say Paul Henri Paul was scapegoated? I mean, because I know you have questions about some of the way that the inquest and things were covered.
Well, if you look at the film, which I knew before the funeral of Diana, that, of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury would call for prayers for all three people who died. Of course he would, because he's a man of great decency. And of course he did. And at that stage, the Evening Standard came out with drunk as a pig. The speedometer frozen at 180 kilometers an hour. That's 120 miles an hour. All of this utter rubbish. Mercedes said, you know, the speedometer reverts to zero. And when it came up in the inquest, it was proved that the maximum speed ever driven that night was 61 miles an hour. Now, of course, that's fast in a town, but it was nighttime and it was on an expressway and it's Paris. Of course it was fast, but it wasn't 120 miles an hour. And we released that film on the Friday before the funeral because you see Henri Paul parallel parking his Mini outside the Ritz, walking in, interacting with people, talking to them, running up and down stairs, bending down to do up his shoelace, standing with Dodie as close as closer than I am to you, in other words, 2 feet away. Was he showing any signs of drunkenness? Was he showing any signs of being incapable of anything? He's in the corridor with them at the staff entrance at Rue Cambon at the back of the hotel. He runs outside. He runs back in again. He gets them into the car and he drives off. Are those the signs of somebody who's supposed to be several times over the legal limit of drink? Maybe French people can hold their drink better than other nations, but he didn't look like a drunk to me. And when it came to it, the two Frenchmen who took the responsibility for this, the forensic toxicologist and the pathologist, both of them refused to give evidence to the British inquest in London, even by television link. They refused to do it. And there are very serious questions about whether the labeling and the storage, and even there could have been a mix-up between blood samples because, and this is the killer thing, you've got to listen to this little point. Henri Paul's blood had 30% carbon monoxide in it. The blood that was put forward as being his blood had 30% carbon monoxide. Now, carbon monoxide, if you had that amount of carbon monoxide in your blood, you would be reduced to sitting in the corner of your elegant study there, holding your head, groaning and feeling extremely bad. That's what carbon monoxide does to you. But how does carbon monoxide get into people's bloodstreams? Often, and it's a very common way of committing suicide, people put a hose from the exhaust pipe of their car into the car. They sit in the car, they drink some booze, and they go to sleep, and the carbon monoxide kills them. In that morgue where Henri Paul was kept, there was more than one person who had been killed in exactly that way. Is it possible that there could have been a mix-up between the blood samples? Henri Paul has been painted in the blackest terms. I don't know his family. I've never met his parents. I believe in truth and justice. If you actually want to know more about this, and of course you do, this book has everything about this. And it was written by an Australian called John Morgan.
Yeah, well, we actually interviewed him.
We discussed it a couple of weeks ago.
Paul Stokes.
Well, the last, you only have to read the last two chapters. Now, this guy, I went out to Brisbane to see him. He was a forensic accountant. He had no interest in the royal family at all. But then he was struck down with a terrible wasting disease. And while he was coping with this in this rather very, very modest little house he had on the Gold, just off, not near the seafront, on the Gold Coast of Queensland, he went into this with a fine-tooth comb. And he came to the conclusions he came to. And they are extraordinary. As Michael Mansfield QC, Mohammed's lawyer, barrister, said, you know, this is the magnum opus on this thing. He had no axe to grind, and he found the truth of it, which has been largely ignored by other people.
But do you that book, though, builds into an enormous conspiracy theory that includes Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, the CIA, the MI6, the French. I mean, is really quite a thing, and I don't know whether I buy it, but I've read the book.
He based it only on published sources, And, of course, now it's much more difficult to get to the record through the National Archives. But you know, this guy, he was so ill, and yet he did this magnificent work. As I say, I went out there to meet him. He moved around his house on a sort of little contraption. It's the only way he could move, and every few minutes he had to. It was quite awful. But why I think this is
fired himself, though. You know, I guess you're still your boss at this point. Alleged Prince Philip was pulling the strings for this massive conspiracy. Did you believe it was like that, or do you think it's just unexplained details?
Well, I tell you what is true, because I know it to be true, and I only speak of what I've seen, heard, observed with my Mark One eyeball and these oversized ears, heard, was that Diana was extremely scared of the Duke of Edinburgh. She was very, very scared of him. And this manifested itself in several ways. She made light of it in some things about she knew about him. But on the other hand, she was very frightened of him. And he wrote her letters. Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, wrote her letters from time to time, which she kept in a mahogany box, along with tapes, interviews she'd done with people. And she called those items her crown jewels. When she died, and she was, her estate was, nobody took charge. Let's put it like that. Her mother and her sister went there and burned a lot of letters. But one of the things that happened was that her butler took away 330 or 320 items, including the mahogany box, including these letters. And one morning at his house, florist shop up in Derbyshire, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the police mob-handed, surrounded the place, raided it, and up in the attic found all the items that he had taken from the princess's apartment at Kensington Palace. I believe that they weren't in the slightest bit interested in the dresses and the handbags and the bits and bobs. They were interested in the box. And the box has never been found, nor has its contents, ever since. And of course, that raid led to Burrell being prosecuted for stealing these items. And in a most completely unprecedented set of events, the case was underway when the Queen intervened to say that, yes, she remembered Burrell had discussed with her the fact that he was taking away the princess's items at her and agreed to him to do that. And over a long weekend, Alex Carlisle was the QC, one of the great and good of this country on every other committee or other. He was Burrell's counsel. He will never say what happened over that weekend, But the case was suspended while things were sorted out, because they didn't want Her Majesty the Queen appearing as a witness in one of her own courts of justice before one of her own justices in a case argued by her own Queen's counsel. It couldn't possibly happen, could it? But whatever happened to the mahogany box and the letters?
And what do you think was in the box? I mean, what did it say? You say
the letters that she had received. She had received it. And they, when those letters were produced, or some of them at least were produced at the inquests, they were completely redacted. It sort of said, "Dear Diana," and then "Regards Pa" at the end. Everything else in between was completely blacked out. We will never know. But she was frightened of Prince Philip, her father-in-law. She knew more about what goes on in the royal family than I did. She lived within it for 15 years. And do you know what was absolutely outrageous? Is that there is nothing in our famously unwritten British constitution that says a royal prince or princess cannot appear as a witness. At this moment, Prince Harry is limbering up for another session in the witness box in his cases against the Associated Newspapers, The Sun, and others. In the 19th century, the Prince of Wales, who became King Edward VII, he appeared in two notorious cases, Victorian cases. And you know, Princess Anne has been prosecuted for having a dangerous dog in more recent years. So there's nothing that says a member of the royal family cannot appear as a witness. But both Prince Charles and the Duke of Edinburgh were allowed not to appear at the inquest. And they sent, well, Prince Philip sent along his private secretary. Well, that's, how can you possibly send your private secretary to go and answer questions of which you are the only person who has direct knowledge of?
Well, there you go, Andrew. You are our expert at getting hold of documents from inside the royal family. There's your new target, the mahogany box.
Well, I don't think we're going to see those. But I mean,
what do you think? Do you think that the establishment press is interested in any of that? Of course they're not. Of course they're not.
Well, I mean, we are probably running out of time, but it's. I really wanted to end by asking you about the crown. And I know, Andrew, we started with this. We never actually got around to it. Because the portrayal of Diana in this latest series is a bit downbeat and sad, isn't it? It's very much a victim. A lot of people who knew her then, or I've met, like Jefferson, say, well, she was funny and smart and flirty and professional, and she wasn't always sulking and sad. I don't know what you think of the way they've done it.
Well, with regard to that, taking up your time, I respond to your questions. I respect you too much to give you brief answers. If you ask a question, you deserve at least some of the detail. So therefore, if I've been rather prolix, please forgive me.
Oh, not at all. No, we love
it.
It's just
we only have an hour.
Listen, I'm not down on the crown. The crown is well written. It is well directed. It is mostly well acted. The first two series, or seasons, as they love to call them, of The Crown depicted a wise, witty, winning, and very, very beautiful young Queen Elizabeth II, played by Claire Foy, memorably. Those two seasons had Buckingham Palace purring, the courtiers hugging themselves with glee, because they were a brilliant advertisement for a constitutional monarchy. Later seasons have dealt with more troubled times, more difficult questions, and scandals. And therefore, all the critics have come out with their heavy boots and laid into them and pointed out errors. And then we had the spectacle of two former prime ministers, Blair and what's his name, same age as me,
Major.
John Major Ball. John Major giving the show a good kicking, so that now it was bullied into having to put up a health warning at the start saying, this is not a documentary factual program. It is dramatized fiction. Well, of course it is. It is not a fact-based documentary. What it is drama, and dramatic license is taken. And of course there are errors. Shakespeare's plays are littered, historical plays are littered with historical errors. But does that mean that they don't reveal greater truths? Well, I don't think many people would have argued against that. Of course they do. Is it true to the spirit of what happened? Is it falsehood? I think you have to accept dramatic fiction or fictionalized drama, and the accent has to be on fiction, because I hoped most earnestly that Peter Morgan, who is the writer of this, is a brilliant man. I mean, nobody complained about his play about the Queen, because it flattered the Queen, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
He's a hugely talented man. Mm-hmm. This series has won awards. It is a work of art. It is not a work of documentary reportage. But is it unfair? I think we mustn't overlook the fact that it will be extremely painful for a lot of people to watch this. I'm steeling myself to watch it. I haven't watched this latest series because I hoped against hope that Mr. Morgan and his team would stop at the end of season 5, but they've gone on to season 6. And that, of course, does involve the terrible deaths. The circumstances are appallingly awful. I spent 6 months at the inquest learning and listening to the details of how they died. And it is a terrible story. I'm not looking forward to that. But my pain and my anguish is nothing compared with the families. And I'm quite sure that they will find it very, very, very difficult. Prince Harry, I know, saw every last second of what's been shown to date, but he apparently, through some spokesman or other, has said that he won't be watching this because it will be too close to what really happened, the death of his mother, the recreation. And also the fact that Diana is then depicted as a ghost. Well, do ghosts work as a dramatic device? Charles Dickens.
Shakespeare thought they did.
Well, I've never thought that Banquo's ghost works at all. Charles Dickens has got 3 in Christmas Carol, but that's a Victorian fairy tale. I don't know. One episode, you have the Queen talking to the ghost of Diana, the apparition of Diana, saying, "You really turned the House of Windsor, or turned us upside down and succeeded." Well, Diana was extremely patriotic. She had huge respect for the Queen. She was so patriotic that she was only allowed to choose one piece of music in her wedding, because, of course, it was all orchestrated by her husband, who knows everything about music. And she chose "I Vow to Thee, My Country," the most patriotic hymn you could possibly think of. It also has Prince Charles weeping over her corpse at the hospital in Paris, and her appearing as a ghost saying, I really did love you. Well, that amount is true, because she did tell her sons when they got divorced that they had been, their parents had been in love when they married back in 1981. So that much is true. But the worst thing about this, according to the accounts that I've read, is to say that Mohammed Al-Fayed contrived their love affair, somehow orchestrated it. Well, Diana was 36 at the time. Diana Dodi was 42. Okay. Mohammed had many talents. He had many gifts. But it was impossible to make two adults fall in love with each other. Even perhaps Svengali could have done it, but Svengali was a fictitious evil magician. It's impossible to make two people fall in love, but they did fall in love. He was extremely pleased. He was delighted. He loved his eldest son. Of course he did. And the family, Diana had been a family friend for many years, and her father and stepmother were extremely close to Mohammed over many years. And another thing, I mean, they, Dodi and Diana, didn't just meet that summer. They met 10 years earlier. They knew each other on a social basis. It wasn't until that summer that they got together and they were romantically involved. And I revert to what I said several years ago with you, that she wouldn't have done anything that would have embarrassed her sons and opened them up to bullying or ridicule at school. I don't think she would have gone with Dodi if she didn't intend it to be something lasting and personal.
I think we should probably have you back for answers as long as you like when you've seen it, because it's been so interesting talking to you.
It's wonderful. I mean, there's so much we want to talk to you about, so I hope you will be able to come back.
We've got an hour. We're going to do 30 minutes. thank you so much for your time, and we would love to have you as part of our little podcasting gang going forward.
Good. Nice to speak to you.
You
nice
too.
To speak to you. Thank you so much, Michael.
All the best.
So, Andrew, when does
this see you in Madeira?
This will come out on Monday, so we'll send you a link to it.
Do you edit it or do you run the whole thing?
I'll probably, the very beginning, I'll chop off probably because we're just going on about, you know, how old I look.
There's a bit of censorship goes on there. But otherwise, this will give us a very good episode, and I think it will interest a lot of people.
I won't send you the bill because I know it won't be paid. But how did you do this? Did you do this with Morgan Stitt?
We did it with Paul Sparks. His friend, Sparks.
We'll send you the link to that.
I don't know who he is.
He was a TV producer who worked on the documentary that started Morgan on his quest.
Interesting. Well, it's fascinating.
It is. Lovely to meet you.
My great pleasure.
See you at Reed's.
And that charming wife of yours is much too good for you. Now I know
she's
that.
Far too good for me. She does know that already.
Shaved. Who knows?
You let me have your address. I'm going to send you that sort of Wilkinson sword razor blade.
So. Yeah, well, I mean,
not to kill yourself.
You mentioned Kevin Costner. I was going for his look. Talk to you later.
Listen, if Andrew and I can shave our mugs, so can you.
Well, I probably can. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.